reopening, Huffcor led to the offshoring of manufacturing jobs, the hollowing out of Wisconsin.
We have five
seconds.
It's
a clear economic choice.
Well, Congressmember Ro Khanna, we want to thank you for being with us, Democratic Congressmember from California. Tune in on November 8th for our three-hour election night special. We'll be broadcasting live starting at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's 6 p.m. Pacific. That does it for our show. Check out our job listings at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is the middle of the WEFT Courier. Coming up next is Disability Beat. But before that, this hour of programming is brought to you by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts and the listeners of WEFT. Krannert Center's 2022-23 season is underway, featuring a diverse selection of music, dance, and theater performances from both national and local artists. Please visit KrannertCenter.com for details. Krannert Center, because the arts matter. And now here's today's episode of Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with a rebroadcast interview with Mark Raymond, executive director of the Split Second Foundation. But first, disability news for the week of October 31st, 2022. According to a recent joint statement, American, Delta, United, Alaska Air Group, Hawaiian Airlines, JetBlue, and Southwest Airlines are committing to a series of steps to improve travel for people with mobility, cognitive, and social disabilities. The airlines say they will each create a passenger accessibility advisory group to work with the disability community to improve policies and operations. They will also improve passenger transfers and handling of wheelchairs and other mobility aids, enhance disability training for employees, and back further study and development of accessibility features. According to their statement, quote, passengers with disabilities represent one of the fastest growing traveler segments, and we recognize the importance of facilitating a safe, seamless journey for them. We recognize the need for a specific commitment to remove barriers to safe, accessible air travel, end quote. Increasing pressure from disability advocates on the airline industry to improve the travel experience for those with disabilities is credited for the upcoming changes. Earlier this year, the U.S. Department of Transportation proposed a rule requiring accessible lavatories on many more planes, and the agency issued its first ever Bill of Rights for air travelers with disabilities in July. The Transportation Department recently said that it is planning to require airlines to accommodate people in their personal wheelchairs on planes in the coming years. In coming weeks, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in a case focusing on how families and schools go about resolving disputes over services for students with disabilities. The case, known as Perez v. Sturgis Public Schools, raises two questions under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. First, the court will consider whether families that have settled IDEA claims can pursue lawsuits under the Americans with Disabilities Act without exhausting all administrative proceedings under IDEA. Also, the justices will decide if families must exhaust those administrative procedures under IDEA before they can seek monetary damages that are not available under that law. The case was brought by the family of Miguel Luna Perez, who was deaf, after the Sturgis Public Schools in Michigan failed to provide him a qualified sign language interpreter for 12 years. According to the court filings, the family was told that Perez was on track to earn a high school diploma, but months before graduation learned he would only receive a certificate of completion instead. The family settled with the school district over Perez's claim of discrimination under IDEA, but then brought suit under the ADA in an effort to seek monetary damages for the harm suffered. The Court of Appeals denied Perez's ADA claim, determining that by taking the settlement, he had not fully exhausted the options available under IDEA. In their case, the family states that, quote, it essentially requires children with disabilities to turn down even full IDEA settlements and forego their ability to immediately receive an IDEA-mandated free appropriate public education to preserve their district non-IDEA claims. There is no way that is what Congress intended. The Sturgis Public Schools asked the Supreme Court to decline the case, saying that the questions were moot anyway because of a recent decision from the Supreme Court finding that, quote, emotional distress damages are not recoverable under the Rehabilitation Act. The Supreme Court is expected to hear arguments in the case sometime early next year, with a decision likely in June. And finally, every Halloween, the Pennhurst Asylum in Philadelphia, a former institution for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, is turned into a haunted house drawing large crowds from the public. Critics say that organizers are profiting from the suffering of almost 11,000 people who were institutionalized at Pennhurst over almost 80 years, and that turning the facility into an entertainment attraction makes light of the true terror people experienced while living there. Those who work at the haunted house say there is another side to the story, a community of people with disabilities who participate in the show because they feel it's empowering and preserves Pennhurst's history. The Pennhurst State School and Hospital opened in 1908 as part of a state-funded effort to segregate people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. It was never an asylum or a psychiatric hospital, but it warehoused thousands of people called inmates rather than residents or patients. Pennhurst closed in 1987 after its deplorable conditions and abuse were exposed in the 1960s by a local television station, followed by patients' rights lawsuits. The property remained vacant for 20 years until the state sold it in 2008. The new owners turned Pennhurst into a Halloween attraction in 2010. Ever since then, the Arc of Chester County, a local advocacy organization for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, has been trying to get the property owner to stop the attraction. The organizer's chief executive, Jean McRance, called the existence of the haunted house, quote, horrible and traumatic. James Conroy, a medical sociologist and the co-president of the Pennhurst Memorial and Preservation Alliance, recalling his visit on opening night in 2010 as sickening. And that's the news for this week. And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, joined today on the phone by my guest, disability advocate Mark Raymond Jr., who is the CEO of the Split Second Foundation. So, Mark, I'd like to welcome you, first of all, to the program. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Vicki. I'm so excited to have this conversation.
So let's start out by you introducing yourself to the listeners. Let everybody know who you are and why you've gotten into the field that you have.
Absolutely. Well, my name is Mark Raymond Jr. I'm a 33-year-old from New Orleans. And basically how I got introduced to this space was my own life changed in a split second on July 4, 2016, after a diving accident in a local lake left me paralyzed from about the chest down. So I dove off the back of one of my best friend's boat and I shattered the C5 vertebrae in my neck. And of course, you know, that initial situation going through inpatient care and navigating the healthcare system really just opened my eyes to how under-resourced the disabled community was.
Mm-hmm.
I only spent about 6 weeks in inpatient therapy, where I, you know, barely got a taste of how to live this life. And once I was discharged, you know, the onus of that responsibility of my care was on my family. Mm-hmm. And I was blessed to have a strong family that could support me and push me and love me and provide, you know, all of the things that I needed to develop and thrive in this new situation. But I noticed immediately how other people who didn't have the same circumstances that I did were affected, you know, much more negatively. And we were all dealing with the same level of depression and grief as, you know, together. But, you know, those who had strong support systems and resources around them just took steps towards a better quality of life and acceptance of this life much quicker than those who didn't.
Right.
However, I got into outpatient therapy and was probably there for about a year before I was discharged because, again, insurance dictated that I was not making physical gains and it was time for me to live this life on my own outside of, you know, getting occupational therapy and physical therapy. Which was another huge blow because the expectation there was that my family, who were already doing so much for me, could add to their plate exercising me every day, right? Because if I don't live, if I don't exercise, if I don't move my body, I'm subject to some type of secondary complication, a bed sore, a pulmonary embolism, cardiovascular situations, right?
Yeah.
So it was just adding another element of my care back onto my family. And I wanted to do something to change that. I wanted to be able to start with some type of fitness program that could really impact the lives of people with disabilities. And that was like the initial concept of the Split Second Foundation. The reason that, of course, we named it Split Second Foundation was because anybody's life can change in a split second, and every day somebody's does.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many split second stories I have heard from clients at my fitness facility and then other people, you know, who almost had the same type of injury or, you know, had a stroke and have gotten better. I think everybody is susceptible to that split second moment. But for us, it's about providing the resources and the care and the what's next, so that people get back to the best quality of life as quickly as possible.
Right. Now, my daughter was born with a disability, so that experience is, you know, completely different because we were dealing with it from day one. But you became an advocate very quickly, obviously. Your accident was in 2016, you said? Yeah. So, I mean, really just a few years and you have just dived in with everything you've got. So how does your experience with disability, did you have any awareness of what the system was like prior to your accident? Did you know anybody with a disability or was this completely, everything was new?
Everything was new. The people that I did know that had gone through strokes, I don't think, like most people, I ever really paid attention to the details, right, of what it took for my aunt to live that life, you know, and the struggles that she had from a communication perspective or, you know, just getting dressed, right, getting fed. Like, I saw it, but I didn't see it. And when it hit me, you know, like everyone else, it was just like the light bulb moment, and how do people do this? I've always been active and a problem solver. I have a degree in chemistry, so like my brain just went to like turning to, okay, what can I do to solve and provide resources and to fix some of this, right?
Yeah.
You know, and it's such a huge basket of barriers, right?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about those so that we can spend all the positive time on the solutions that you've developed. So what are the barriers that you recognize?
The barriers were, one, big time, access to resources, mm-hmm. especially like capital, financial resources. I think most people living with a disability live on a fixed income,
mm-hmm.
Especially, you know, the more severe the disability, the more limited that those resources are, be it Social Security or Medicaid. Another huge barrier, access to fitness programs so people can stay healthy, right, outside of occupational therapy and physical therapy. When we know insurance is minimizing the amount of visitations people get.
Mm-hmm.
Another huge barrier, access to living opportunities, right? It's not enough accessible housing in the country. So people go through these experiences and then have to adapt their homes. I know I had to build an accessible bathroom that cost $20,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, thankfully I had parents who could afford that. But what happens to that family that, you know, dad has a stroke, mom has to quit job to take care of them? How do they make those renovations, you know, on such a fixed income? So another barrier, another huge barrier is transportation, getting people to and from doctor's appointments, to and from fitness opportunities, to and from physical therapy, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's such a limited structure. And I think also policy and the way, you know, the ADA hasn't been substantially amended since its initial inception, right, in 1990. And there are so many industries that have popped up, such as like Uber and Lyft and Airbnb, that don't really have enough accessibility. Same thing with the airline industry. Like, for the life, I can't figure out why there aren't at least two spots on every plane for a wheelchair
mm-hmm.
to be able to just lock in instead of us having to transfer into an aisle chair, you know, and be the first one on the plane and the last one off. That's a barrier. So I've actually missed flights because my connecting time was too short, or because I'm waiting for these guys to get my wheelchair and it took 30 minutes, you know?
Mm-hmm. Not to mention the broken wheelchairs that happen.
Not to mention the broken wheelchairs. And then I think about the more societal barriers, right? When we have to look to the end of every block once we're on a new block to make sure we can get down. So if there's not a curb cut, and just accessibility in a city. All of those things really make life a little bit more tricky. And that adversity, I feel, has really pushed me to, you know, step up as an advocate and as a leader to push other leaders and other, you know, be it government officials or developers or architects, to think about disability more holistically. And not like, you know, not like the stepchild that you just need to do a few little things for and check some boxes, right? A more accessible world is a better world for all of us, because you don't want to have to avenge and fix all of these things on the post after your life changes.
Yeah.
And so that's been my kind of approach through all of this.
So you
first recognizing.
So you started the Split Second Foundation. What is the role then? What does the Split Second Foundation do? How does it help?
Well, the Split Second Foundation has been helpful in, one, identifying all of these problems, and then, two, creating solutions, right? So the first program that we launched was Split Second Fitness, and it operates as a either in tandem or post outpatient or inpatient therapy fitness experience for people to continue their recovery and rehab journey.
Mm-hmm.
We charge $50 a month for our clients to come. With that, they get access to our facility and 2 one-on-one sessions a week with our trained staff who knows how to deal with a host of different disabilities. So it's about an $850 value that we subsidize by throwing large events and raising grant funding. It's our show of love for the community, right?
And you're talking specifically in New Orleans, right? You're not like across the country yet.
Not yet, but that is the goal.
Mm-hmm.
I think we recognize that this need exists everywhere, although New Orleans is a poor city. And in the initial, the startup was here. It was, how do I solve some of these problems in my home first? But, you know, quite honestly, now I get messages and emails and phone calls from people from all over the world, you know, asking how they could participate in this program or to bring one there. And that's just the first program. The second program, huge need around this was as people transition from inpatient therapy back into society, who's their quarterback or how are they being connected to resources? I.e., every state has like a bucket of resources that people can tap into.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Louisiana, it's Louisiana Department of Health, Louisiana Assistive Technologies, Louisiana Brain Injury, Louisiana Rehabilitative Services. But a lot of people don't know how to navigate those systems. So we actually recently got a grant to fund our first or the launch of our case management and mental health program that will serve as both a mental health resource to help people deal with the grief and think through, you know, what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
While also providing them with more of a life coach. I don't want to call them a social worker, but a life coach who can help them navigate the future of this situation and get back to a good quality of life. Underneath that program, we plan to do a lot of our workforce development work as well, right? Because what I've noticed at our fitness center is a lot of my clients still have the capacity to work.
Oh,
right?
Sure.
It's just about finding the right situation for them. And so we've been really intentional about developing our next initiative, which really fits into this conversation, which is our education, employment, and internship initiative.
Mm-hmm.
We're calling it EEI, right? But the whole focus of that is to educate people on how to live this life, educate caregivers on, you know, do's and don'ts, and let us guide you based off of our experience dealing with these situations. Next is, you know, where can we find you work, right? Whether that be from an internship perspective or just outright employment, and connecting with different companies who are truly passionate about hiring people with disabilities.
I would imagine, too, that there are a number of people that you've worked with or talked with who had jobs prior to their disability that require a lot of mobility. And what, you know, there must be challenges in trying to figure out what kind of job would best suit that individual and something that they would like to do in their life.
Exactly. You know, going back to the entire purpose of all of this is to really enhance a person's quality of life. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. Like, we all want to feel good about the work that we do, right? I don't think, you know, I think everybody wants to make that choice, too.
What did you do, Mark, before you had your accident?
I was working as a broadcast engineer, so I was traveling the country doing very technical work, basically putting NBA, NFL concerts and the like on television.
Mm-hmm.
So my responsibility was setting up the audio, the visual, making sure satellites worked. I was really immersed in the broadcast engineering world.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that job required really functioning hands and being able to reach and lift. And, you know, unfortunately for me, after my accident, it was a job that I could not return to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm sure that's true of many people. So to put your energy into something where you are you know, doing good for other people is commendable for sure.
Well, I can say that I've lived two full lives thus far, and I loved both buckets of work that I've been able to do, both as a broadcast engineer and now as an advocate and a thinker. I think I get to be a lot more creative in the space that I'm in now and solving problems.
Mm-hmm.
Although both of those, you know, career paths was heavily rooted in problem solving and dealing with people. And I've just been blessed to have great people around and pushing me.
Sounds like it. It really does. But talk a little bit about the barriers for employment. Other than accessibility, have you found any outright just people, employers who were afraid of hiring somebody with a disability? And where does that fear come from?
I think the fear comes from a place of productivity. So, let me reframe. The answer is yes. In talking with other clients and even my own experience, trying to navigate that initial time frame, you know, it's not like I have a degree, right? I'm pretty mm-hmm. smart. People, you know, weren't exactly saying, "Hey, Mark, you know, I understand. Why don't you come, you know, try and do this job for me? You can help in this capacity." So that part was missing, but also, from what I've seen, you know, my clients go through is like you'll start a job, and I think the expectations around productivity have really instilled that initial fear
mm-hmm.
in folks with disabilities. Whether that be, you know, just getting to the job site, being able to fully do the job, but I think through the pandemic we saw a huge shift in that thought process, because a lot of work became virtual.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw a slight uptick in the hiring of people with mobility challenges, for example, in different spaces. But I do feel like some of that, or the majority of that fear is just around productivity and capacity to do a job, or the fear that this disability is going to, you know, hinder this person's ability,
and not having experience with people that have disabilities in general, I think also contributes as well. So people want to get more information about the Split Second Foundation. What's the best way to do that?
Oh, please visit splitsecondfoundation.org. You can learn all about my story, about the programs that we offer, and more broadly, our initiative to build community. I think that's what's most important in this space, is to give people a place where they feel comfortable and at home and safe. Because once you give them that, and once we give them hope and love, you start to see the light in people.
Yeah,
you know, and they start to lean more into, okay, this is, I can live this life. I can do this. Right, he's doing it, she's doing it. You know, let me just navigate this and figure this out, and I think I can, you know.
One person at a time, isn't it?
Yeah, well, one day at a time and one person at a time.
That's right. Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining me today. Mark Raymond, Jr., CEO of the Split Second Foundation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Vicki. Y'all have a great day.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great rest of your week. And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. Coming up next is Food Sleuth Radio. Stay tuned for that and other great programming here on WEFT Community Radio all evening long.